Welcome to Crime Over Wine Weekly. It's Monday, March 18th. I'm Heather Hawley. Here are your crime headlines. A New Hampshire judge declared Harmony Montgomery legally dead last week. This comes after the five-year-old's father was convicted in her murder several weeks ago. Her body has still not been found. Court documents show Harmony's biological mother requested she be declared dead so that she could pursue a wrongful death lawsuit. The Utah author charged with poisoning her husband may have had help from her mother. Eric Richens died from fentanyl poisoning in March 2022. His wife, Corey, went on to write a children's book about grief before authorities charged her in Eric's murder in 2023. Newly released court documents reveal investigators believe Corey's mother may have helped plan Eric's death. According to a search warrant, Lisa Darden's partner unexpectedly died from an oxycodone overdose in 2006. That death is considered suspicious, but Darden isn't charged in either case right now. In Michigan, a married man is charged with murdering and concealing his girlfriend's death. A fisherman discovered Christina Barber's body in a bag in the Flint River a week ago. Surveillance video shows Barber and Christopher Mautry entering a room at the Flint Motel on February 28th. The next day, Mautry is seen leaving the room with what appears to be a body in a plastic bag. Investigators learn Barber and Mautry previously worked together at Burger King, and co-workers say he had a history of violence in the workplace. Barber leaves behind seven children. Coming up on Crime Over Wine Weekly, could a Boeing whistleblower be the victim of a massive conspiracy? What John Barnett shared with a family friend right before he allegedly took his own life. Plus, after 2 years on the run, a Louisville mother is behind bars. We have the latest in the pursuit for justice for the boy in the suitcase. But first, let's check in with Liam and Michelle and get this Monday going. How are y'all doing?
Hello. Happy Monday.
Hello. Kicking off a brand new week.
I am so excited to be back here with you guys. We took a week off to kind of reset a little bit, and we are back here also on a new day. Y'all can expect us on Mondays from now on. We think that this is the best way to kind of move forward to serve you guys better, and I'm just really excited to be here.
I'm really excited about this new day because it's like kicking off a week, kind of, you know, getting reset and like what's going on, especially after the weekend. You know, sometimes you're off doing your own thing. So here right. We are, we've got you covered with what's going on and getting you ready with kind of what to follow and what new developments happened, you know, over the weekend.
Yeah. All to kick off the new work week. We know that a lot of y'all like to listen to us, on your commute into work. And so what a better way to start off your Monday than with a little Crime Over Wine Weekly with Michelle, Liam, and Heather. And some wine as well. Michelle, this was your week to pick out our wine of the week. So what'd you get for us?
I picked Frisk Prickly Riesling. And this zippy Riesling is floral and delightful with notes of lime sorbet, nectarine, and a floral lilt. And it has a low alcohol to support its light body. It's only about 10%, delivering racy verve, subtle complexity, and just a tinge of sweetness. It's a perfect companion for both sweet and spicy dishes or just simply on its own. Refreshingly complex on the palate, it will make you wonder how you emptied your glass so quickly and have you reaching for another. So, are we ready?
That sounds like my kind of wine. Y'all, like, listen, you don't have to convince me to finish a bottle, for sure. But that's the fact that they're just, like, expecting that from us. I'm like, these are my people, I feel like.
I'm excited. All right.
Excited. I also, so I'm not typically, like, a huge fan of Rieslings either. Y'all know I like dry wines. But I feel like, you know, it's been, like, warm in Chattanooga the last couple of days. I feel like a Riesling is kind of exactly what the doctor ordered this week. Like, it's giving a lot of like summer spring vibes.
It's definitely light. It's got like a little bit of like a carbonation, like just very, very little, but not a lot. And it is a little bit sweeter.
And so somebody just very recently taught me about what that's called in viticulture. When it tastes a little carbonated, like it feels a little carbonated, and I can't remember what it's called now, and it's going to kill me. But that is so that's like a really distinct kind of, you know, feature on wines, is when you kind of get that little bit of carbonation, but like obviously wine's not carbonated unless it's like carbonated, like sparkling rosé, or sparkling wine. And so, but I need to like go Google it and report back. But that's a really like unique, interesting feature, and specifically in whites, I feel like.
Okay, Heather, I'm interested in what you're thinking.
I'm enjoying it. I'm not getting the flavors though. Lime, not getting. Nectarine, not getting. But I do enjoy it. My palate's broken, I guess. I don't know.
That is a delightful kind of events for Heather actually enjoying one of our wines that Michelle and I picked out.
Okay, but I know you can't see me, but when I first opened it, I smelled it and made a face. So I wasn't hopeful, but enjoy the taste much more than the scent.
One of these days, we're going to pick out the perfect wine for Heather.
It doesn't smell very good. Definitely not like how it tastes.
Yeah, I had very low hopes. I was like, oh, we'll be pouring this in like a chicken recipe or something.
Not the chicken.
What chicken are you making?
I don't know. We use wine to cook all the time. That's what happens with most of our leftover wine.
I just Googled it, and I was reminded that that fizzy kind of carbonated taste is, or feeling that you get for certain types of wines, is called effervescence, and it's like how the wine was fermented throughout their process. And so it's depending on whether or not it was fermented in a tank or a barrel, like stainless steel, or you know, an oak barrel, that's influential on how much effervescence is in the wine. So there's a little wine tip for the week. I had to Google it to remind myself, but here we are.
Interesting. I learned something new.
Yeah, there you go. And I think, like, from my understanding, like, the more, like, the longer that a wine is fermented in stainless steel, the more effervescence it tends to have. And so that's the you know, kind of rule of thumb, I suppose. But so actually, speaking of effervescence too, I'm pretty sure that I learned this while I was recording this week's episode, because Amanda Trotter did our live show for the week, or did our live show a couple weeks ago, and then I just dropped that episode this past week in Crime Over Wine. She's my new wine friend. She knows way more than I do, frankly, and that I think probably says a lot. But this week we talked about the case of Jamie Faith, who was a husband who was gunned down in Dallas, Texas, right in October of 2020, right in the thick of the pandemic. And so what did y'all, because Heather, you were at the live show recording, Michelle, this was the first time that you heard this episode come out in Crime Over Wine. So I'm just kind of curious to kind of get both of y'all's reactions now that Heather has had some time to think on it. And Michelle, you're just hearing about it, you know, very, very freshly.
I really liked it, and I wish I could have been there, because I went to the first one that you did, and that was so much fun, and being able to sit with other people and also like kind of talk and mingle about like what's going on and feed off of you guys, like you really get that in the listening to it. You know what I mean? Like you feel like you're there. Which is the next best thing if you can't be there, you know?
Right. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Not everyone can travel to Chattanooga. But hey, maybe one day we'll be doing tours, the three of us, on Crime Over Wine, right? So everyone can get a chance, but you know, to hear us. But y'all will have to, everyone listening right now, we'll have to tell literally everyone you know about this podcast in order for us to get there. But right now we're just chilling in Chattanooga, I suppose. But what a crazy intense case too, right? I mean, the details here when I was first reading about this, I was not expecting the twist to come toward the end. And again, go listen to the episode if you haven't, because otherwise we're about to spoil it for you. But I was not expecting where this whole thing ended up going at the end of this whole thing. Did y'all kind of piece together what may or may not have happened?
No, it was very much like a made for TV type thing. It didn't seem like how it played out. It's like, just like a movie, and now I'll never trust a man with an orange tea on his truck.
Well, yeah, I think you're going to have a hard time in Tennessee then, girl. But I think you probably already figured that out.
I just don't understand how a woman like can manipulate people the way that Jennifer Faith did. Like, And the fact that she has done this to multiple men in her past, it's kind of like, what mental illness is there or something like that? Like, I just, that's insane to me. And it's just, it's tragic how dangerous it all turned.
Yeah. And I keep going back to also like Darren's past too, Michelle. And so like because he was an Army veteran, a Green Beret, and like only got, like left the Army because he had a traumatic brain injury. And so like, I keep going back to like, to that fact of like, was he even in his right mind? I mean, obviously, I mean, you have to be like a certain level of whatever to like think that, you know, murder is the best option here. But he clearly wasn't in like the, you know, the right mindset to like make a logical decision. And it almost makes me wonder like how traumatic the brain injury was and like how much Jennifer knew that, you know, how traumatic his brain injury was, to kind of manipulate that. And then besides that, how insulting it is, you know, and this is a totally different podcast, I feel like, but how insulting it is to like actual, you know, victims of domestic violence, you know, who have been through this and like actually feared for their life on a regular basis, for her to just like make up the story is sickening, on that front as well. And for her to like loop somebody else into this whole thing to like do her, you know, dirty work, for lack of better words, is you know, evil as far as I'm concerned. I believe she was sentenced to life, and so she certainly deserved that
to save her own life. Essentially, she will spend the rest of her life in prison. I do feel like I should share more. So I'm personally connected to this case by the way of Darren Lopez. He is the stepfather of my best friend from high school. My best friend and I, we cheered on the cheerleading team together. He came to every single game and was taking pictures and getting us Gatorade and hot chocolate, like very much like a cheer dad, a father, you know? Mm. And I remember when they had other daughters, like her younger sisters. And I just remember him gleaming, holding the babies. And he was just the dad that everybody would ever want. You know what I mean? And so definitely he did multiple deployments, very decorated Army veteran, very proud to serve his country and proud of, you know, the things that he did for his country, you know, saving multiple people so that they are still here today after being blown up in Iraq. And so, and at the expense of, you know, his own health, receiving those traumatic brain injuries. And I think depression also kind of mixed in with that. And it just made for the perfect storm of being able to, you know, here he is in his mind, he's reconnected with, you know, his high school sweetheart and just looking for a little bit of happiness. And I think Jennifer Faith kind of pounced on that vulnerability that Darren had.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. And I think back to also like the fact of, and thanks for sharing that too, also Michelle, with everybody, your personal connection to this, but, you know, I also think back to, you know, where we all were in 2020, right? Like where we're all, you know, like, you know, just trying to get through and like maybe feeling a little lonely, frankly. And like, you know, Darren was clearly feeling very similar. And so like, again, another thing that like she kind of took advantage of there, that like there was something that he had recently been divorced, right? Or like had just, you know, recently lost his wife. Michelle, correct me here if I'm wrong. So point being is he was very much so like in a bad place, right? And like a lot of us were. And like, again, she pounced on that, in my opinion. So,
and it's just, it's crazy to me because I understand, I can see that Jennifer may have been unhappy for whatever reason, you know, in her marriage, but like, why not just get a divorce? Like,
right.
You know what I mean? So many lives would be different today if she had chosen just to do that.
Yeah.
Including her.
Yeah, and then it, like, you know, obviously there's, like, a lot of explanations behind, like, the insurance policy that she tried to get. Like, she, you know, again, there was, like, a whole other part about, like, all the money that she schemed out of people through, like, the GoFundMe page that was set up for her. I mean, there's a whole different avenue. Again, go listen to the episode if you haven't yet, because there's a lot to unpack there for sure that, like, could point to, like, why, you know, why do that instead of, you know, getting divorced. But yeah, I mean, just a lot to unpack there for sure. And, you know, and again, thanks for sharing that with us, Michelle, because I think that perspective is valuable, to, you know, really getting, you know, at who we're talking about here, not just like what we're talking about.
All right. Coming up next, we are going to have some news of the week, and we have some really interesting cases that you're going to want to stick around for coming up right after the break.
But first, 34 years ago today, on March 18th, Danette and Jeanette Millbrook disappeared during a walk home in Augusta, Georgia. Rumors have swirled about their disappearance, but they have yet to be found even to this day, and no one has been arrested in their case. If you know anything about their disappearance, call the Richmond County Sheriff's Office at 706-821-1080 and listen to their full story on episode 47 of Crime Over Wine. Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to BetterHelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp.
After being on the run for over 2 years, the mother of Cairo Jordan, a 5-year-old whose body was found in a suitcase in rural Indiana, is now behind bars. Dejon Anderson was arrested in California on Friday as she was about to board a train. The suitcase with Cairo's remains was found by mushroom hunters. Police say Cairo died from an electrolyte imbalance, most likely caused by vomiting and diarrhea, which resulted in dehydration. Police identified the boy's mother and her friend, Dawn Elaine Coleman, as suspects in the case. Both have now been charged with neglect and obstruction of justice. Anderson is also charged with murder. Coleman pleaded guilty to a charge of conspiracy to commit murder in relation to Cairo's death and is now serving a 25-year sentence in prison. Both women made several posts on social media referring to the child as a, quote, demon and, quote, an avatar playing a character before Cairo's death. This case was really hard to just research and learn, because it's, you think about a 5-year-old and the fact that he died from an electrolyte, you know, deficiency, yeah, or like dehydration, essentially, like just how painful, and, you know, 5 years old and the only person that you have to rely on is your mother, you know, and she's not giving you, you know, what your body needs to survive, just a slow, painful death. And then to be stuffed in a suitcase and disposed of, like, it's just, and the fact that they referred to him as a demon, like, I just, that it hurts my heart, because no children are so pure and innocent, you know what I mean? And it was hard to read.
Yeah, and what I don't really fully understand is, like, how the heck did this woman go on the run for 2 years? Like, where was she? Like, that's what's more, like, infuriating for me. Like, A, obviously the fact that you can do that to a child, like, different level of evil, and, like, she's the demon as far as I'm concerned. But, like, allegedly, again, she has yet to go to trial. But, like, how do you then dispose of a child of their body, like, don't tell anyone about this, and then just, like, go for the rest of your life? For the next 2 years, just as, like, you know, knowing what happened, just, like, in hiding, like, refusing to take, you know, responsibility for what you've done. Like, how do you live with yourself?
And maybe with her being on the run, maybe that was her trying to put it out of her mind. I don't know. I don't know how you can have something like that of that magnitude on your conscience. I do know they found her in San Francisco, and she was about to get on a train. I don't know if that was, you know, if she was planning on going somewhere else or, you know, just taking like a regular train ride as far as like, you know, transportation. I'm not sure, but they were able to track her down, and that was where they served the warrant.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know like where else she was for the last 2 years. Because Indiana to California is pretty far. And, like, if they knew where she was or, like, and was trying to find her, like, if they had evidence of that, if they were tracking her down for the full time. And then, again, like, to have somebody else involved, like, to bring your friend along. I mean, like crimes against children, like, different level of evil as far as I'm concerned. I just don't understand. And especially against your own child, sickening.
And the fact that both the women were calling him a demon or an avatar. There is some detachment from reality there between the two of them. And I don't know if they got involved in some cult like group or something that could have persuaded them to feel that way. But for a mother to call her child that, and then also have a friend that she's convinced or also believed on her own, they're not all there. Like, they can't be all there to be that drastic in their opinions of a young child and his behavior like that. Like, have I jokingly called my children little demons when they stand and scream at me because they're tired? Yes, but I know that they're just tired children.
Yeah. And also too, like, because I just Googled it like very briefly. So they were also from Atlanta too. So how the heck they ended up from Atlanta to Indiana and then she ended up in California, like, that is a totally different story that I frankly need to know about more. But like that, like, just the processes there are insane to me. That's how you can go about it. And then I would like to know more, and like maybe this is like for a further episode, but like Dawn's involvement, like she's serving 25 years, which is pretty intense. I would just like to know how she was involved and like what she did to help, I suppose.
From what I learned as I was like doing the research, so she kind of, they lived in the Louisville area, and Indiana isn't that far, like, from there. It's kind of like Chattanooga, where we are we're close to other states. So I know that the mom had done some, she had been kind of in and out of jail and stuff. And so apparently she did like a 2-week stint in jail, and that was where Dawn took care of Cairo. And I guess they had some family in that area and they were staying with family. So that kind of seems like that was like home base a little bit. And that's kind of why they were there. But then what Dawn said is that she walked in a room and the mom was on top of the little boy, and the boy was, Cairo was face down on the mattress, and the mom had said, "It's already done." And that was when Dawn helped her put him in a bag and then in the suitcase, and then they drove out to this rural area in Indiana and tossed the suitcase, and then they also tossed their cell phones apparently in that same area. And that was when a little bit later the remains were found by the mushroom hunters.
So if she found the mom on top of him, does that mean she suffocated him? Like, because if the cause of death is an electrolyte imbalance, like, Did she hold him down so he couldn't sit up while he was vomiting and he choked? Like,
that's where it's vague. That was, again, like, those details just come directly from her. So, unsure.
Yeah.
It's not totally clear, but I think it, regardless of whatever happened, it just sounds like the condition of that little boy, like, he couldn't fight back. You know what I mean? Especially, and being five, like, just.
Yeah, he definitely was suffering in his last days, yeah. Weeks, months. And I mean, also emotionally, I can't imagine the mental and emotional pain he had to feel. Cause there's no way he understood what was being said about him or why they felt that way.
If he even knew that what was happening to him, right? I mean, like, yeah. A lot of kids, like, you know, just accept, like, at 5 years old, right, Heather, you know about this, right? Like, you are just, like, being told what your parents, like, what your like, you know, parental figures are, you know, expecting you, you know, to do, and, you know, what, you know, you're following their lead, and, like, maybe this is just what they thought, you know, being, like, a five-year-old was like, is that, like, that, you know, you're not given your proper, you know, the proper nutrients that you need or whatever it may be. Like, you just rely so much on your parents. And that's what gets me so angry, is that, like, you rely so much on the adults in the room to, like, you know, to learn what life is supposed to be like, or, you know, for basic things, right? Like, for food, for that kind of stuff. Like, he couldn't go to the grocery store himself and get what he needed. Like, he didn't know what he needed. He didn't have the opportunity to get that. And that's what always makes me so angry about these types of situations, is you just rely so much on the adults in the room to do the right thing and to show you what the right thing is. And the fact that he just didn't get that, it destroys me.
Yeah. At that age, you only know what you know, and
mm-hmm. what you're taught.
Your brain isn't developed enough to question that. You know what I mean? And you just have this instinct to trust your parents, your caregivers, who's raising you.
It reminds me too a lot of Mariah Woods. We covered that on episode 6 of Crime Over Wine, where she, if y'all remember, so she was she had muscular dystrophy, and she literally couldn't walk without, like, needing support. And her parents, or, you know, her mother's boyfriend, despicable as far as I'm concerned what he did to her, but, like, point being is that, like, he, like, some, like, there were adults who needed to be there, and, like, you know, who needed to put up the boundaries of, like, what's right and what's not, and et cetera, and, like she just relied so much on people to like survive and to just do her thing and, like, and to live, and like they failed her over and over and over again. Joseph Zarelli, the boy in the box, episode 25, like that one is a totally different situation, but just, like, the same thing, where just, like, people, like, were responsible for this child, or should have been responsible for this child, and just weren't. Same thing. And it just doesn't make any, it'll never make any sense to me how somebody could see a child and, first of all, call them a demon or whatever, but, like, you know, to do horrible things to them.
Okay, Heather, what do you have for us this week?
This is another one that's going to make us upset in a variety of ways. A North Carolina woman and her two young children were found dead in their apartment 12 days after they were reported missing. 22-year-old Markayla Johnson, 4-year-old Miracle Johnson, and 7-month-old Messiah Johnson were reported missing on March 3rd, but police didn't share any information with the public until March 8th. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg police chief says he doesn't have an answer as to why there was a 5-day delay in sharing the Johnson's missing persons report, and the department works to get that information out as quickly as possible. Friday afternoon, officers found Markayla, Miracle, and Messiah's remains at their home while carrying out a search warrant. During a news conference Saturday, the police chief shared the three were murdered and they were looking for the person responsible. Less than 24 hours later, police in California captured the suspect, Benjamin Taylor, near the Mexico border. Investigators say Taylor was in a relationship with Markayla. He faces 3 counts of murder and 1 count of concealment of death. Right now, Taylor is waiting extradition.
Wow. I mean, just the fact that they waited to share any information, but I mean, I'm glad that they did find him before he crossed over into Mexico.
Yeah, and so right now the details of how they died haven't been shared. Reports specifically have said remains and not bodies, but not sure that that's just media quoting a release or vice whatever. But they, like, was it a slow death? Could they have been saved if police had gotten there sooner or what? But at least they had the search warrant and checked that day, another day later, and he would have been gone.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about this, Heather. So do we know how who reported them missing?
No one reported specifically who it was, but her family was at the news conference Saturday with the police chief. So it kind of sounds like they filed the missing report.
Okay, so I guess if it's like a full family, I suppose, and then like maybe that makes a little bit more sense, because I always think about, right, like me, like, you know, as the frequency of me getting in contact with my family, like I feel like if nobody really heard from me, or like I didn't really respond to people for like a week, like that is probably like a good amount of time. But like a full family, right, where it's like your children, you know, like, you know, you expect, like, a mother expects to hear from their children after a certain amount of time, and vice versa, and like they just kind of stick together. So like that, like 12 days sounds a little intense for me. But also, so like the fact, so like I just have so many questions for this, the police department also, and it sounds like maybe they have even have questions for themselves. I feel like that they should be a little bit more like upfront about like what exactly happened here. But like the fact that they were found in their own apartment, like after waiting so long, that doesn't make any sense to me at all, because it feels like that should be the first place you go after someone's reported missing. You'd think so. No?
Yeah. So from the pieces I'm putting together from a variety of reports, it seems like just like red tape that they had to go through this process on the police side of, there was the missing person report. They talked to the people who last saw them. They missing persons investigators ran all of their leads. They looked into all of the reports they got from tips after they posted the missing person information. And after they exhausted all of those efforts, they were able to get a search warrant to go into the home.
Well, sure. But like also, like if you are reported missing, like that to me triggers a welfare check. No. So like, I don't know, maybe they did, like, maybe that's just like they can't enter the home even if they, you know, if nobody's letting them in. So like, sure. But like, it just feels like it feels like a little bit of like, you know, like failure, frankly, of like something that, you know, like maybe, like you said, Heather, maybe if, you know, people, someone did respond earlier, then we would know, like we wouldn't have been able to save somebody. Like, who knows how, like, and I don't know, or maybe not. Maybe they, you know, what they know about this situation that they haven't shared with the public yet is, you know, very clearly like a situation where like there was really nothing that could have been done. But it just, again, I, like you said, I'm getting angry about this, and I just always get like upset over, like, it just like, and I know there's like a lot of red tape that goes into this that like is beyond this, you know, like true crime policy anyways. But like, it just, I always say that if somebody's a little bit out of their, you know, normal pattern, like that should be enough in my opinion. Right. Like, cause if somebody has a normal pattern, then like that, then, and they're out of that normal pattern, then that's weird for that person. You know what I mean? But like, what's weird for me might be not weird for you. Like, sure. But I don't know. It just feels like they dropped the ball a little bit here. And like, again, like they should have a little bit more ownership to it. And like, I don't know, maybe they are trying to figure that out. I know as true crime lovers, we want answers a little bit quicker than most of the time than we can get them, but still.
The fact that there's a 4-year-old and a 7-month-old, like,
right.
I don't know what the laws are, but why wouldn't that trigger some sort of like Amber Alert and kind of up the urgency? Because there's just two very, very young children that are missing, essentially. Yeah, and maybe something more could have been done had it not. I agree with you. It's maddening.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good point too. I didn't even really think about that. Like the fact that they are minors, like triggers, like there are laws in place that say, I don't know about it, the laws in North Carolina, but there are laws. And I think it's a federal law that says that if a minor is involved, you have to investigate that right away. Like regardless of the circumstances of the situation, like you have to investigate that right away. And so especially a 7-month-old and a 4-year-old, like you would think that would be like right away, like let's figure out what's going on here. But again, I mean, I guess you can't just like barge down the door. So like, I don't know. I don't really know exactly what their options were, but it feels like the options were a little bit more open than what they're making it out.
Something that the police chief did say during the news conference this weekend was that they didn't know what they had until they dug deeper into the investigation. And to me, that kind of feels like we didn't take it as seriously as we should.
Right. Which, again, like I just have to say it because we say it all the time and it proves itself to be true over and over and over again. Like this, it's a black family. And so like, I have to imagine that if they were a white family, it may have turned up a little bit different. I like to imagine that it wouldn't, but like, I have to imagine that it would.
There really isn't a lot out yet though. Cause he'll be extradited. Then we'll start getting affidavits once he's booked, which will have more details in it. Medical examiner hasn't even looked at the bodies yet. So it's still really early in the investigation. I am pretty impressed isn't the right word, that they find the bodies, name the suspect, and get him when he's about to cross the border. So that was pretty fast turnaround there.
I mean, if you're crossing the border, like that triggers something, right? Like you are put into a system and like a big red bar pops across. But I don't know, like I'm not really giving them a whole lot of credit here, frankly, because I don't really feel like they deserve it, in my opinion. But
well, it kind of makes you wonder, like, what maybe, like, did he tell family or something, like maybe another story? Or even police, maybe like early on, to where they didn't take it seriously enough. And then that gave him time to like kind of plan his like escape plan, essentially. Or I wonder if like she might have like a history of kind of like leaving or going off the grid. I mean, I'm just trying to think of it from maybe like the police perspective. I mean, that doesn't make it okay, but you know, the fact, like Heather, like you mentioned, you know, they didn't realize what they had on their hands until they looked further.
Yeah. And that's fair. And that's a decent point. Like the fact that like maybe this was just like in her normal behavior to like not be around for a week or two at a time. And like, again, to that point too, Michelle, like maybe there was a story out there that, you know, led them to like, you know, think that this was normal or there was no there, whatever it may be. So like, that's a decent point.
We'll definitely keep an eye out for new details that will be coming out in the next few days as the medical examiner begins their work and the suspect gets back to North Carolina. But until then, Liam, what do you have to share?
Oh, man, guys, I have a doozy for you guys this week. Have you all been paying attention to what reportedly happened to a whistleblower at the plane manufacturing giant Boeing? Well, I'm about to go down a whole long conspiracy theory here, but you all know that I love a good conspiracy theory, so bear with me. 62-year-old John Barnett was found dead in his car, which was parked in a hotel parking lot in Charleston, South Carolina, on March 9th of this year. The coroner ruled his death a suicide by a single gunshot wound to the head and said that he was found with a pistol in his hand. But there have been some serious red flags raised surrounding his death because of the significant concerns that John raised years before he had died. John retired from Boeing in 2017 after 30 years with the company. And if you remember, in 2019, Boeing had come under serious scrutiny over its manufacturing processes that had resulted in mid-flight emergency landings and other safety concerns too. Well, as part of that scrutiny, John had spoken publicly about concerns he had about Boeing's manufacturing processes, including stressed workers who had been placing ill-fitting parts onto the Boeing 787 planes to meet their quota, and that testing of the emergency oxygen system showed that 1 in 4 emergency oxygen masks wouldn't work in the event of an emergency. According to the BBC, Boeing denied all of this, but an evaluation by the Federal Aviation Authority, or FAA, did uphold some of the concerns that John had spoken publicly about. Now, a big reason why John's death is being scrutinized as it is because, again, Boeing is being criticized today for issues with its planes. If you remember earlier this year, a door blew off of a Boeing plane shortly after the plane took off from the airport in Portland. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, found that 4 bolts used to keep the door in place were not fitted properly, and the FAA had found multiple instances where the company did not meet quality control standards during manufacturing. Now, all of that may just make me sound like some, you know, insane, you know, tinfoil hat, insane conspiracy theorist here, but except listen to this part. Last week, WCIV, the ABC affiliate in Charleston, spoke to a close family friend of John's and reported that John told her something cryptic shortly before his death. The friend, who only wanted to be referred to as Jennifer, told the TV station that John said, quote, "If anything happens to me, it's not suicide." And this was in the same conversation as them talking about an upcoming deposition he had about the whistles that he blew back in 2019 about the alleged manufacturing issues at the plant. And like, listen, y'all, like, again, I may sound like a huge conspiracy theorist here, and like, you know, if I'm wrong, you know, pin me to the board kind of thing. But like, I don't put anything past like these really powerful rich people to, you know, do whatever it takes to like, you know, to uphold their reputation and, you know, protect their cash, and also to, you know, to hold people responsible or, you know, accountable or whatever for, you know, making them look worse than they you know want to look. And like, again, no one at Boeing has ever been you know even you know framed as a possible suspect, at least not publicly, as a result of this death. And it is very much so ruled a suicide at the current moment. But the Charleston Police Department also said that they are still very much so investigating it. It's still very much so open, even though it's been ruled a suicide.
I'm sorry, but if you tell a friend, if I die, it was not suicide, I'm going to, and then you die, and they say that it's suicide, I'm not going to believe that. I'm not going to believe that, especially with this whole situation that he had on his shoulders for trying to step up and do the right thing. Like, I don't think it was suicide.
Yeah, no, I'm 1000%. No, I'm on team. Like, there's something like very much so fishy here. And also too, I just have to say, like, Charleston, the Low Country, has some like weird stuff happening. Like, again, like, do I have to mention Alec Murdoch? Like, there's just a lot of like really deep, you know, old money down there that like, you know, an old tricks kind of thing. And like, I don't put it past anyone down there to like do something, you know, a little shady as a result of this horrible whistleblowing, you know, attempt that John had made. And like, because if you say that kind of thing too, Michelle, like to that point, if you say that kind of thing, like you have to have good reason to do that. Like, you have to have really good instincts to do that. Like, you don't just bring that kind of thing up out of thin air just because, like, there's something you think there's something weird kind of happening or whatever, just because. Like, you have to feel it in your gut that, like, you know, your life might be in danger. And he did specifically say, to be fair though, like, Jennifer told this reporter that John said that he wasn't afraid for his life necessarily, but he did but in that same breath said something along the lines of, you know, if something happens to me, it's not suicide, period.
I mean, for people who have as much money as the Boeing executives have, one life is not a drop in the bucket for them. Like, human lives are pennies for them. So I wouldn't put it beyond someone that wealthy to silence someone.
Yeah. And again, I go back to like the fact that like the, like these like companies who like, again, like they go deep, like they, like the people who run these places go deep and like have connections, like know the people. And so I, like, and it's worth it, right? Like, and there, like, I could see how it could seem worth it anyways to like, you know, make someone go away, you know, just to protect the brand, like to protect the thing. And then it makes me wonder too, like, what more is there, right? Like, again, like this is, I'm already have like my whole thing about planes and stuff, which is again, a different podcast. But like what else is there that you're thinking about that makes you that is worth doing that like isn't already out there, right? Because like the one thing that can happen beyond that, if it's really this big conspiracy that we're all talking about here, right, like the only thing that can come of, you know, you making that person go away is just more scrutiny, more conspiracy, you know, you end up as a subject of a podcast, right? And so like what could be worth that, what is else is out there that could be worth that if we're really going down this big long conspiracy path?
Well, and also like, you know, what happens to the case now, you know, now that he can't go and you know, testify in this deposition. So like what happens? I mean, obviously, like, he had been talking for years, you know, I think what he brought this up in like 2019. So there's obviously like documented stuff, but it does make you wonder, you know, here he was stepping up and doing, you know, trying to do the right thing and share what he knew. And now he's not here anymore.
Yeah. And to that point too, John's lawyers very much so said that they plan to continue on with that deposition. So that way they don't have to, you know, so this is not going to make his complaints or his the whistles he's blowing go away. And they've already, I mean, it's been 5 years since he's made these concerns public. And so he's very much so like expressed that fully. It's going to obviously complicate some things, right? Because, you know, you know, if you can't scrutinize it, if he's not here to scrutinize it in a trial, to that point. But then again, I also say, you know, what comes down to like, you know, John's death specifically, the Charleston Police Department very much so says that they're looking into this. Like they're just like taking it, you know, at face value here. So like, and you know, who knows what they'll end up coming up with. But it's very much so an open thing. Like they are very much so looking into this and everything is going on, you know, regardless of what happened to John. You know, to someone's dismay potentially, or, you know, or maybe, you know, to someone's credit or whatever it may be.
Has there been any mention of a note or anything left behind, or just the cryptic message to the friend?
Not that I've seen, Heather. Yeah. Which to that point, like a lot of those things, like, and there's a lot of different stuff here, right? That I didn't mention, but like a lot of those, you know, a lot of suicide cases, like that's the telltale sign of like, if there are no, can we prove that this person wrote it? That doesn't exist here, but there is some like really interesting, actually fascinating thing that I didn't know about, you know, from a crime perspective, but they specifically said that, an expert, in this case specifically said, that in like, or told the New York Post, that I think they said like some 25% of suicide cases that involve a gun, the pistol or the gun, you know, ends up out of the person's hand. And so in this case, John, when they found him in his car, that he still had his pistol in his hand. And so that seemed to this expert anyways, you know, seemed to, you know, be a telltale sign that this was not necessarily a suicide and, you know, maybe was a little bit of a blunder on behalf of who may have killed him. Because they, you know, put it back into his hand, just thinking that that's just what would happen. But like, you know, scientifically speaking, that's not what happens. And so that's really interesting. Again, it does happen occasionally. So like, you know, take that with a grain of salt, I suppose. But then there's also the fact that other employees too also raised similar skepticisms to media outlets too. They said that, you know, that they're not totally convinced yet that they, you know, that John, you know, may that. Killed himself, because based on what they know working for Boeing, they know that John had made some quote very powerful enemies, as a result of you know, blowing the whistle on all this stuff, again, 2 years after he retired. So, I mean, I put a lot of stake into that. Again, the people who know him the best saying that, that something isn't right here, I put a lot of faith into that as well. And then there's a couple of the details, too, that I didn't mention that I'll just kind of briefly mention in kind of rapid fire here. But so the police department said that there's some like weird stuff about this hotel as well, because, again, John like lived in Charleston. So I don't really understand why he was living, why he was staying in a hotel. But like, maybe that's just beside. But the police department said that he had actually just extended his stay in the hotel by, I believe, a day up until March 8th. And so he was seen on surveillance camera leaving the hotel that morning on March 8th, as he should have. But the staff also says at the hotel that he ate dinner at the hotel that evening, that they had him, that they saw him at the restaurant, like beyond when he should have been staying there. And that they also found his driver's license still in his room. And so like other weird things, like, again, I guess if you are going to commit suicide, maybe you don't really care about your driver's license, but like just a lot of weird things that just like aren't totally adding up perfectly to like what we know for sure about John, which again was that he was supposed to leave the hotel that morning and he didn't necessarily up to the point where like they literally found his driver's license in his room beyond when he should have been staying there.
I don't know what to think of that.
Yeah. I mean, it could go either way, I think, potentially, but I don't know. Again, y'all better believe that I will be keeping you guys updated on this. I'm obsessed almost as much as I'm obsessed with Kate Middleton, which I'm, much to my dismay, we're not talking about in this episode. But I have a lot of theories there. I will be keeping y'all updated as this one goes on, because there's so much to talk about for sure. But coming up next on Crime Over One Weekly, where is Sebastian Rogers? The 15-year-old with autism disappeared from his bedroom in the middle of the night. The latest in the search out of Middle Tennessee when we come back. Plus, authorities are searching for a North Carolina teen who's been missing for more than a month. What Laquanda Robinson's family thinks happened to the 15-year-old girl.
Hello, Crime Over Wine listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
Hello, everybody. This is Liam Collins, the host of the podcast Crime Over Wine, and I'm about to make your Wine Wednesdays so much better. We know that there is nothing better than hanging out and listening to your favorite true crime podcast over your favorite bottle of wine, and that's where we come in. Every week, we share a new head-scratching true crime story while reviewing your new favorite bottle of wine. So your new true crime adventure is waiting for you. Crime Over Wine drops new episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Authorities need the public's help finding a missing teen from Kannapolis, North Carolina. That's about half an hour from Charlotte. Police say Laquanda Robinson was last seen at A.L. Brown High School on February 1st and hasn't been heard from since. Laquanda's family tells the Black and Missing Foundation they believe she was lured away by someone online. Laquanda is described as a Black girl with a medium complexion. She's 5'5 with brown eyes and shoulder-length black hair. If you know anything about Laquanda's whereabouts, call Kannapolis Police at 704-920-4000.
I wonder why do they think that she was lured away by someone online? Like, was she known to, like, talk to people online? Or maybe they, like, went through some of her accounts and found some messages or something? But yeah, the biggest question that jumps out to me is like, why do they think that?
No one has elaborated on that part. The family says that she's an honor student and excited to, she was going to pursue a career in criminal justice. So they're worried that they haven't had contact with her. So it sounds like this is out of character. She's normally a, you know, focused honor roll student, and this is unlike her behavior. But as to why they think she was lured away, they didn't elaborate that part. And I haven't seen anywhere where law enforcement directly said it. The Black and Missing Foundation says that law enforcement also believes that she was lured away, but I have not seen where law enforcement themselves have said it.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because I've only seen that from through the Black and Missing Foundation as well. So I wonder if that's just like more of like a theory than like an actual like investigative thing that they have. But I also, because so I just like was kind of clicking around, and it always makes me like a little mad, but like also a little like suspicious slash maybe like a little relieved about how little information there is out there. I mean, we're like a month, you know, from when Laquanda went missing, but there's just like these stories, and like they all pretty much say the same thing about like, you know, Annapolis police are looking for this 15-year-old girl. This is when she was last seen. This is where she was last seen. This is how you can report it if you have anything. It was interesting because the reporting that I saw stated that officials said that they believed that Robinson left on her own, but they didn't go into as much detail as it sounds like the Black and Missing Foundation does about why they think or that or how they think that necessarily in terms of how she may have gone off because of a, you know, person that she was talking to online.
Yeah. So two things to add on to what you just said. The Black and Missing Foundation did an interview with another group online, and in that they say that they're in contact with her family and then had talked to them like a day ago. But when you go online and you look at her name, and the news reports that do come up are just quick web posts from a release. They're all written very similarly, have the same minimal amount of details. So she's gotten like minimal coverage in her local market alone. Like, no, it doesn't look like anyone's spoken to her family or anything yet. So I don't know why in that area it doesn't seem like this case rises to the threshold of more than her picture and a quick blurb for one day.
Yeah. And like, again, we always go back to like, you know, it, like, she's a young Black woman and like, or young Black girl, and like, you know, who knows what, how that, you know, plays into the amount of attention that she may or may not be getting. But then it also kind of on the flip side of the coin, like, makes me wonder, you know, what police may know about the situation. Like, you know, like, again, if they, like, I have to believe in like my heart of hearts that like any investigative agency, like regardless of you know what color their skin is, like, you know, sees a young girl, you know, who's not with her family, and like just does absolutely everything they can to make it to bring her home, and just like, you know, really gets the same level of attention as like Gabby Petito or like or Mariah Woods did or whatever it may be. But so like the fact that they're like putting out like this kind of drip of information, and like it's early to be fair, but like this kind of drip of information like makes me wonder that maybe they do know a little bit more and like realize that there's something that isn't necessarily suspicious or foul play or whatever it may be. But to your point though, again, Heather, like they like the family very much so says that she's, you know, a good student, all that stuff. And so it doesn't really sound like her to just like run away or to do whatever. So like maybe like kind of maybe the Black Missing Foundation is kind of onto something here about, you know, the messages or what have you. And a lot of times, yeah, too, the family can like, you know, put out like more information than they should. Like I've seen that time and time again. So like maybe they do know about these messages, and maybe police haven't put it out for a good reason, but family did.
And whether that's the case or, you know, she's a 15-year-old girl having a rebellious moment or whatever, just hope that she is found and is safe.
That's fair. I can't even tell you how many times I've tried to run away at 15. Or thought about it.
It's just for people like to think of it as like she just ran away. She met someone online. Like, let's just take that theory. She met someone online and they were giving her, you know, attention, and it felt good, and maybe telling her, you know, things that she was wanting to hear, and being rebellious at 15, you know, just kind of given the age, even though it sounds like she's a good kid, a good girl with a lot going for her, and is trusting whoever this person might be, and, you know, just goes. Anyone that takes advantage of that, that's alarming. You know what I mean? Anyone that, like, takes advantage and convinces a teenager to leave everything that they know, like, that is alarm bells. Like, who knows what else they're going to take advantage of, you know? So to her, it might be willingly that she's leaving, But at the same time, she's not seeing that someone is taking advantage of a vulnerability that she has because of age and maturity and, you know, just where she's at in life, you know, and taking advantage of her trust.
Yeah. And to that point too, like we've seen that over and over and over again, a lot of times, right. Where it's, you know, young children don't know what they're getting themselves into, right. Like don't know, you know, the dangers of going off with an older person or whatever a stranger that you don't know. Like we've seen that a lot. And so it's possible that that's the situation, or maybe there's something more sinister here. Like who really knows? Who really knows? Right. Like, I don't know. It really could be kind of what, like, the Black and Missing Foundation, it sounds like to me anyways, like what the Black and Missing Foundation, you know, is saying about how she may have been lured away from by someone online. Okay, sure. But like, it also could be a situation where she very much so wanted to go away with that person. But either way, she's young. She's a minor, and like, let's find her and like, let's try to bring her home. Cause like she's in danger either way, as far as I'm concerned, if she's not with her family.
We will definitely be keeping an eye on Laquanda's case, and hopefully that has a positive resolution soon. So Liam, who are you telling us about today?
So I'm bringing the heavy hitters this week, I guess. I have another hefty case for you all. Get ready for this. This week, I want to tell you all about Relisha Rudd, an 8-year-old girl who went missing 10 years ago this month. At the time, Relisha was homeless, living at a shelter in Washington, D.C. with about 600 other children. Relisha being missing was first realized when a school social worker went to visit Relisha at the shelter after several days of unexcused absences from school. The social worker went to speak with a doctor named Dr. Khalil Tatum, who had reportedly been treating Relisha at the shelter for migraines. But when the social worker arrived at the shelter, they were shocked to learn that Khalil wasn't a doctor at all. Instead, he was a janitor at the shelter who, you know, that Relisha had gotten close to. The social worker reported Relisha missing and called the metro area's child abuse hotline. The search for Relisha officially began on March 19th, 2014, 18 days after anyone reported seeing her. The very next day, on March 20th, Khalil's wife, Andrea, was found dead in a hotel room, and warrants were taken out against Khalil for murder. But Khalil was later found in a park in D.C. dead from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. From what I can tell, Khalil was never named an official suspect in Relisha's disappearance, but he was considered a person of interest by investigators. Relisha has still not been found, and directors with the Black and Missing Foundation won't be convinced that she's still not alive out there until they find her. If you know anything about Relisha Rudd's disappearance, call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI or 1-800-225-5324.
Like, there's so much to unpack there. Like, wait, what? Not a doctor? What do you mean he's a janitor? Like, there's nothing wrong with janitors, but like, what?
Yeah, and I don't really know if he was like actually treating her for migraines while being a janitor, or if that was just the story that the social worker was told. But yeah, and again, like to then to find out that like the janitor may have possibly killed a woman, his wife, insane.
Why do they think she's still alive?
So that's a good question. I don't know that for sure. And kind of a good note here, potentially, I suppose, Relisha had, as I kind of alluded to there very briefly, developed a very close relationship with Khalil. Again, inappropriately, she's a minor. And like, he's a janitor working at the homeless shelter that she lived in. It's just inappropriate all around. But like, the family very much so knew, acknowledged, and was okay with the idea that Relisha was with Khalil, or was like thought to be with Khalil when she was missing. And so when all this time had passed that she wasn't at school, and the social worker was like, what's going on? The family, you know, said, oh yeah, well, she's with Khalil. Like, it's not a big deal. I don't really know if the family thought that he was a doctor. Like, again, the doctor thing is just bizarre, but the family was very much so okay, point being, because of the relationship that they knew that he had with Relisha, that they were very much so okay with Relisha being with him, and that's why she wasn't around. Different can of worms in terms of questions, but that's what they had said after she was reported missing.
It's a lot going on there, but like, it feels like Khalil's the one person who could have given us answers beside Relisha, and that opportunity is gone.
And I wonder, like, why did he kill his wife? Like, what? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions there, too. And, like, I started going down that rabbit hole, and then I was like, okay, this is about Relisha. Like, let's wind it back a little bit. But for sure, I have a lot of questions about Andrea as well. Again, we're probably maybe a lot of questions that we won't get answers to because Khalil, you know, is believed to have committed suicide. And again, I feel like maybe Andrea also knows a little bit more about Relisha as well. Like, Ariane, this all happened. Like, she was reported, anyone had last seen her on March 1st. You know, the search for her began on March 19th. Andrea was found on March 20th. So, like, this is all kind of happening all at the same time. Maybe Andrea knew a little bit more about Relisha. Like, maybe there were clues that lied with her as well that we just don't know yet. But yeah, I don't really know why exactly they think they, like, when the Black, again, like, going back to what we were talking about before about the Black and Missing Foundation, like, the Black and Missing Foundation very much so was the one floating this idea that, like, oh, we don't really know, like, she may still be out there, like, she may still be in California, or, like, you know, maybe, like, who knows? Was in a population of people, you know, people experiencing homelessness that are very transient, like, very much so, like, unreliable, frankly, in terms of, like, you know, repeated habits and that kind of thing. And so there's that much. And, like, clearly the family wasn't very, you know, interested in keeping tabs on her whereabouts. So, like, it's possible maybe that she went off and went somewhere else. And, like, again, maybe the Black Missing Foundation knows more than we do. Doubt it. But point being there is that it's just kind of like it seems like another one of those examples of, like, you know, the Black Missing Foundation just very much so keeping all options open. And that's kind of where we're at.
And, like, his position as, like, a janitor at this homeless shelter, like, I would think that it would probably be easy to get rid of evidence if he wanted to. I mean, I don't like thinking like that, but I mean, he would have had access to ways to get rid of things than, like, maybe just the average person.
Well, and, like, not even just that too, Michelle, but, like, the fact, like, of where she was living at the time. Like, this is a chaotic situation in a very populated city, right? So, like, 600 kids, and that's just the children, to be clear. Adults were living at the shelter too. So, like, there's a lot happening, right? Like, there's a lot of people in and out constantly, and, like, it would be, to that point, like, it would be very easy to, you know, if a child goes missing, to kind of cover up evidence and move on from that. And so regardless of who did it, right? Like, it wouldn't necessarily surprise me that you know, ended up happening. And then I should also mention too, this shelter doesn't exist anymore as of 10 years ago, and to my understanding, partially because of this situation, but it's now been, like, broken up into much smaller homeless shelters throughout Washington, D.C. The way it's been described in reporting was that it's now, like, a shelter with the intention of getting people housed directly, as opposed to this, like, I guess what it was before was just this, like, massive shelter just with people living there because they had nowhere else to go. So, like I said, again, that phone number is 1-800-CALL-FBI or 1-800-225-5324. If you know anything about Relisha Rudd, we're going to put that number on our website and in our show notes too. But Michelle, what you got this week?
So it's been 3 weeks since 15-year-old Sebastian Rogers disappeared from his Middle Tennessee home. The teenager with autism disappeared from his bedroom in the middle of the night. His mother told police that she went in to wake him up for school, and that's when she discovered that he was gone. They believe that he is barefoot and may have taken a flashlight, but that's all that they are saying that they found. Now, multiple agencies and crews have taken part in this extensive search. They've covered more than 2,000, and despite their efforts, I mean, they've been on the ground, they've been in the air, they were even, you know, Sebastian has autism, and so it can be hard for him to just maybe walk up to a stranger or something like that, but they were playing his favorite song, Eye of the Tiger, to help comfort him, and they were hoping that that would kind of help draw him out of wherever he may have been. That was early on in the search, but despite everything that they've done, there haven't been any clues as to what happened to Sebastian. They haven't found any video. The TBI, they've analyzed home surveillance video, ring cameras, cell phones of his mom and his stepfather, and then even his father. They've even went into Sebastian's gaming system to see if, like, maybe he was talking to anybody. There's been nothing, which is odd. That's what the TBI says. Now, crews searched a landfill just over the state line in Kentucky. And the reason why they searched that was because that's where the trash in the neighborhood is taken. And they said that they didn't have like any specific reason, but they were just not wanting to leave any stone unturned. But that turned up nothing. This case has kind of been overshadowed a little bit here recently from another pretty big missing persons case that's going on in the Nashville area right now. But at the end of the day, you've got a 15-year-old with autism, and there's literally been no clues as to where he went. I mean, how does a teenager just disappear in the middle of the night? And I've watched interviews with his dad, and he said, you know, the fact that he is barefoot, they said he doesn't like being barefoot outside. Apparently, like when he was younger, he got bit by some fire ants, and after that, like, does not like being barefoot outside. So his dad said that was something that was very weird. And investigators are saying, you know, they're considering it a missing persons case, but they have not ruled out foul play. So this is just a heartbreaking. Yeah, this is just all a heartbreaking situation. And since they don't have any clues, like they, you know, nowhere to focus their search, they've kind of scaled back a lot. But they do say that they've been following every tip that comes in, and they've been re-interviewing, you know, those closest to Sebastian and people that he's interacted with, just to see if something might jog someone's memory and help them.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for a couple weeks now, Michelle, the three of us, and like, I just have a bad feeling about this one. Like, I can't really put my finger on it necessarily, but I just don't. Like, I think at first, like, it was very much so, like, a situation where it was like, okay, well, like, maybe he'll just turn up somewhere and, like, you know, and, like, everything will be fine. Like, it'll be a misunderstanding. Like, he's a young boy or young man with a mental disability. And, like, you know, that unfortunately happens. But now that it's been a couple weeks, I just have a really bad feeling. And, like, the fact that they're searching landfills and stuff and, like, haven't ruled out foul play, like, I feel like there's something there that they haven't necessarily made public yet that I just think is going to be a little heartbreaking here. I just have that gut feeling in my stomach about this.
I thought that they were going to find him quickly, but they, you know, they haven't. And just the fact that there's been no, like, nothing for them to, the investigators to go off of is just, it's very weird. And yeah, like this neighborhood, yeah, just like any nice neighborhood out there, there's cameras everywhere, you know, and the investigators have said that they've accounted for every car that was driving in the area or parked in the area. You know, there's just been nothing like suspicious, nothing that they can connect to his disappearance. So I think that's where they also kind of have to kind of work backwards and see when was the official last time that he was seen. You know what I mean? It feels like this case is going cold, and it's like, that's not what anybody wants. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like, certainly not for lack of trying, clearly. Like, listen, like the TBI, as far as I'm concerned, is like one of the best, you know, investigative agencies in the world, you know, because they work tirelessly, and like clearly 2,000 miles for this kid that they've searched is incredible. Like, if it's true that they are just like searching this landfill just because, like, good for them. But so I feel pretty confident that like, if there's something out there, then they will find it, kind of thing. Cause like, because of how like highly I regard the TBI. But yeah, I mean, and like, especially like they're dealing with, this is a very intense situation. Like, they're dealing with a very vulnerable type of person, right? Like someone with autism and someone whose behaviors are not as we would expect as, you know, as would have been how any of us would react to a situation. So like, who even knows what that means? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. It's just all very sus to me.
I mean, at this point, is there actually evidence that he did leave the house? If he hasn't been on any video or anything, is there proof he left?
I don't think there is.
And I don't think that they've actually left the house, have they? I mean, they've checked the mom's and dad's phone records and everything, but if he's hidden somewhere in that house.
And I think that might be why they were searching the landfill. Like, you know what I mean? It kind of like reminds me like a little bit of the Chris Watts case, you know, where what the neighbor like
me, but
had the neighbor had like surveillance video of like his truck like backed up into the garage, and they said that he was like loading stuff in the back of the truck, which I think we now believe that it those were the bodies, or at least the body of his of Shanann Watts, his wife. But so that I'm wondering if that's kind of what they were trying to see, if there's any, if there's proof of any evidence of something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, cause I just don't see any way that a 15-year-old with autism, who, if he actually did just wander off, manages to leave no trace of evidence. It's nearly impossible to do that intentionally.
I agree.
Yeah, like, this is why, like, I just have a lot of questions, and like I just have a really bad feeling about Sebastian here, like regardless of I don't know what happened, but like also so I was just like googling because I was like, because y'all know I'm curious, and so apparently so I'm looking at an article from the Independent, and apparently so WTVF, which is in Nashville, News Channel 5, showed home security footage that showed like two specks of light outside of the family's home, which is interesting. So and again, so like the night that he went, that he disappeared, around like 3 o'clock in the morning, and like so I have like so that's really interesting to me, and also because again, like Michelle, I believe you said that he possibly has taken a flashlight with him, and if there are two flecks of light outside of the home, then that says to me that possibly he was following somebody, and like very clearly, like in this situation, there is like, so like the, I'm looking at a picture now of like the picture of the video that they're, that they put out there. And like, these are very two distinct flecks of light that they're putting out there. Again, it's like basically black otherwise. So like, who even knows, but like, so it's very much so insinuating that the outlet at least is trying to put out there that it's possible that it was two different people, including Sebastian, if it really was.
So yeah, I saw that Nick Barris got that video, and the TBI actually has put out a like kind of a statement about that. They said that many neighbors and businesses have provided video from home and business surveillance systems, and we're grateful for that cooperation. The video has been collected, and from the beginning of the investigation, been analyzed and enhanced when possible by tech experts with TBI, FBI, and Secret Service. To date, nothing significant has been found. It says, we do caution that some surveillance video being shared in the public may have been misrepresented or misidentified or not shown in its entirety. It has been determined that it does not hold any evidentiary significance to the investigation. So that's, they're kind of saying there that to me, they're saying like, no, that video doesn't really show anything. I don't know. Cause I saw that too. And I was like, maybe this is something, like maybe this is it, but they're saying no, which I don't know.
Well, that to me though, sounds like it's not necessarily them saying this specific video. Correct me if I'm wrong though. Like that's how I read it or am hearing it, is that it sounds like it's like, they're saying that it could be, or it could, or like this could be it, or it could be like, they could be talking about something else. No.
Yeah, they didn't like specifically say that video, but I haven't seen any other video being shared in this case.
Yeah, that's fair.
So that's why I believe that they are referring to that video, even though they didn't specifically say that.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's very fair. Yeah, and I also have to say, like, the public information department of the TBI, like, is very thorough, and like, they, like, I remember from Summer Wells when they put out like a whole blog of, and like they updated like every piece of information that they had, like they put in into this like big running blog, and it looks like they're doing something very similar for Sebastian. And so I feel pretty confident that like if there's information out there that we should know about, then they would put it in this situation. And so I will be monitoring this blog very heavily, is the point, because I'm very invested in Sebastian's case and I have a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously We will also, we'll keep you updated here and on our social media pages about the search for Sebastian. But if you have any information about where he may be, what's happened with him, call 1-800-TBI-FIND.
Man, action-packed episode, y'all.
I know. A lot has, gone on, and it was even hard because we took a week off,
Yeah.
Just trying to pick, so much has just gone on, I feel like, in the true crime world.
Yeah. Well, that's why we should never take another week off ever again. The true crime world just blows up when we're not there to cover the stuff. So we have to be on it from now on, I suppose. And y'all can count on us to make that happen. So
No breaks ever.
No breaks in crime. The crime doesn't sleep. Neither do we.
No rest for the wicked or us.
Correct. Or,
And or us. Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you can't get enough of Crime Over Wine, follow all of us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we'll see you next Monday for the next episode of Crime Over Wine Weekly. And we'll see you this Wine Wednesday for your regularly scheduled episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnougan Network.